NAA meeting. My name is Isla. I am an alcoholic, and I'm so grateful to be sober today. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual and our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. I am really looking forward to hearing tonight's speaker. The only thing I know about him is that he's been sober about 5 years and he's a deadhead. That's all I know. And I am very, very anxious to get to know you, Carl.
Hey, everybody. I'm Carl. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Carl.
I'll just do the prerequisites first. 32 years old. My sobriety date is January 30th, 2019. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I'm available to sponsor other men. And my home group is the 545 How It Works meeting here. There's like a little disclaimer. There's a lot of drugs in my story, but my sponsor tells me that I should respect the house I'm in, so I'm gonna try my best to not talk about drugs as much as possible. But I will say, like, for anyone, while I do struggle with, you know, alcohol is a big part of my story, for anyone out there that is new and feels like they can't talk to anybody about stuff like that, I'm a intravenous opiate addict, so I know there's a lot of people that struggle with that stuff, and people like you can't talk to nobody. I'm one of those guys. So other than that, I was born in Eastern Kentucky. And let's see, you know, my dad did not like to drink, but he was very into everything else. And my mom wasn't much of a drinker either, but she also liked to party. And when I was a kid, there was always a party going on at my house. He was a little old. My parents were, like, older when I was born. I was born, my dad was 40. So he is, as I understand it, I think he was forced to retire from the post office. And so he stayed home with me and my sister. And there's always somebody over there and always something going on. And while my mom worked, and then, you know, my mom would get home from work and join the party pretty much. So actually, this is kind of a funny story. Technically my first drink, and this was, I went back home to Kentucky I went to a meeting with one of my dad's friend's wives who's sober now, and she told this story in the meeting when I went there. My first drink, I was like, my mom said she had got home from work, and I had just started walking and was like saying words and stuff, which is like funny for me to think about now, because it's like my daughter's age right now. It's like she's 18 months old, and like that's what she's doing. Like she's walking and saying words. And I guess my dad and all his friends were partying, and one of my dad's friends, he always drank screwdrivers. They said that I called, his name was Jerry, but I thought his name was Juice, because I'd always walk up to him and ask for some of his juice. So I would go up, and they were, you know, he was giving me some of his juice, and then, you know, his other friend was drinking beer, and I'd go up to him and drink some of his beer, and I guess they gave me too much. My mom gets home from work, and I'm, like, sick, throwing up on the floor. My mom's, like, flipping out, and I was probably, like, pretty drunk, it's kind of funny to think about, because I get, like, you know, I guess a young kid probably don't like the taste of alcohol, but I kept going back for it. So, and my mom always, she said, I knew you were going to be an alcoholic when you were a kid, because every time I gave you something to drink, you like just drank it all. You sat there and drank it all. So anyway, that's kind of, you know, I don't know. There was like, I mean, you know, everybody like they weren't like putting the drugs and all that stuff out there, but there was like pretty open use of substances all around me when I was growing up. My dad grew pot, and I used to help him do that. We had a big garden, and like I really like wasn't no different for me than like a green bean or corn or you know, and then he did different things to the to the pot plants, and I was, you know, I helped him when I was real little, and he got busted when I was 13 years old, and the police showed up, and I was in the shed with him, with like we had 10 plants in there that it was like harvest season, we were hanging them up to dry, and so the cops didn't arrest me, but like technically I was guilty as hell standing there with him. So anyway, that's kind of, you know, like I grew up around a lot of alcoholics, and I can't really remember growing up around anybody that wasn't like, most of them were alcoholics, and a lot of them have died from alcoholism, but at least like, you know, heavy drinkers, like that's all I remember. So like, you know, the idea that when I came in here that I can't ever drink, you know, that I'm live a life in abstinence was like I didn't think anybody did that. So anyway, like kind of stretching forward. I like really like of my own accord started using when I was about 15 years old, and I was on the soccer team, and I was a freshman, and the seniors invited me to this party, and you know, they had alcohol and pot, and they were, you know, they got me to smoke some and pushed me in the pool, and it was a good time. Everybody was having fun, and you know, I don't know, like it wasn't like an I had arrived moment, but like I enjoyed what had happened, and I went home, and I told my dad like what I'd been doing. And, you know, he didn't say anything. He said, well, don't tell your mom. But, you know, if you want to do it here, you can do it here. I've always, you know, like pretty quickly, like my sister was like a grade below me. And, you know, I mean, we were in high school, you know, I mean, I was a freshman in high school and on through high school, we, you know, me and my mom found out pretty soon. We all smoked pot together in my house or in their house, you know. I mean, it wasn't frowned upon. Like, it was okay. We didn't have to, you know, it was fine. All my friends could come over and do it with us, and I don't know, man. It's just, thinking back on it, it was a little dysfunctional, but that's how I grew up, so. Pretty soon after that, my I don't know, man. I thought back on it. Like, I think, I don't know. I don't know if he was trying to be cool or he was sick in his own way. Like my dad was sick in his own. And I'm not trying to blame my alcoholism on my father, but it's like it's kind of how I got into it. And I think like by the time he realized that he had made a mistake, it was too late, kind of, or something. But he brought me over to one of his friend's houses, who was, you know, a commodities broker in dry goods. And I got started doing that stuff. And this guy, his brother was the sheriff, so he never really got in trouble with anything. But he was quadriplegic. He was paralyzed from the neck down. And but he was plugged in. But somebody had to be there all the time to actually do all the stuff. Like, because he couldn't use his hands. He drove his wheelchair around with his chin. People stole from him all the time, and I was like, I was 15, 16 years old, so like, why don't you help me do this, and I'll give you a little money and this and that. So I started going over there after school every day, and it was like all the, you know, I bagged things up and served people, and they came in and accepted the money and put it away, and then at the end of the day, you know, it's like all the anything I wanted while I was there, and then I got a couple $100 at the end of the day, and that was like more money than a 16-year-old kid could make working a regular job. And like, why the fuck do I want to get a job? Come over here and party all day. There's like, you know, there were young women. They were older than me, but they were good looking, and they hung around, and they liked me because I had what they wanted. So I was like, this is it, man. I had it figured out, I thought. And, you know, then, you know, being at a high, you know, most high school kids have a little trouble acquiring stuff like that. And it's like, well, I'm just gonna go over here and get it right now. And so I got into the, you know, dealing side of it. And I pretty much did that like all through high school, and I never really ran into like a whole lot of trouble. I got a DUI when I was 17, but the district attorney that prosecuted my case was a regular at the house that I stayed at, and my toxicology reports were lost in the mail, and it was thrown out. So that was like, it's like a nut, like I'm a young guy, I just think like, it's like, I didn't, there's no consequences then, man. And so I move on, I moved on, I got a scholarship to go to the University of Kentucky. I scored pretty well on my ACT, and it enabled me to get a scholarship, and I was accepted to the University of Kentucky, so I moved there, and I was still doing what I was doing. And it kind of like I got to where I was doing it on a bigger scale. Like I met another person, and I could go back to where I was from, and you know, I was like 18, 19 years old, and that's like probably that's like the most, even today, like it's the most money I've ever made in my life, like on a like salary. Like I'll probably never, it was like probably six figures a year that I would make. And my, you know, my habit, I didn't realize like what a regular salary was. So my habit is like, just, I'm spending like, you know, probably $200-$300 a day on what I was doing. And, you know, I've been physically dependent ever since I was 16 years old. Like I needed, before I went to school, I had to do something. And then by the time I finished school, it was time to do it again, you know? And, anyway, so I did that for, I finished 1 year of college. I didn't do too well in college, but I was like passing. And I got, my house got raided. And I had sold a pound of marijuana to an informant. And then, you know, my house got raided, and I had 4 more pounds in the house. I was actually, like, pretty lucky because I was, like, about to walk out the door to go to the guy's house, and they kicked the door anyway. So I was charged with trafficking, controlled substance, arrested, threw me in the jail. And I would, you know, I'd go to court for the next year over that stuff. And I, you know, like then, like the money wasn't coming in anymore. And I realized like, man, how am I going to pay for all this? I had some money stashed away at my mom's house. It was like $40,000. And I blew through that in, you know, like, it was like 2 months. And so I was like, so this is where like alcohol kind of starts taking a big part of my story. Cause I, you know, I drank, but like, it wasn't what got me there. And, I was like, well, maybe I'll pick up this alcohol. And, I started drinking and I was like, you know, like I was drinking one day and like, I like caught a nod, like, and I was, it like real like hit me. I was like, man, I can get there with alcohol too. Like maybe alcohol is the answer to this problem. And I, you know, so I started drinking every day. I was 20 and, still going to court and I pretty quickly became, you know, dependent on that, like drinking. I drank in the morning. I don't know, man, any substance, like there was never really like any kind of honeymoon phase for me. Like I just always was like, I want to do this all the time, all day, every day. Whenever I'm awake, I want to have something in me to change the way that I feel. And, so I got, you know, I got sentenced to, for my, for the trafficking case. I got sentenced to 2 years. And they ordered me to serve 6 months. So I went, I was 20. I went to jail. I served my 6 months. I actually got released on my 21st birthday. And then, you know, then I could buy alcohol legally when I got released. So that was like the first thing that I did. And, you know, I pretty much just picked right up where I left off. You know, I like dried out in the jail a little bit and it was kind of rough. And I had gone through withdrawals a few times, but I just always went right back to it. And so things kind of continued. They just kind of continued that way for like the next 2 years. I started, but you know, I couldn't stay off the other stuff for very long. And I met this girl and we, you know, she was into the opiates also. And so we got, you know, fell in love and we moved in together and we, you know, we were both drinking and getting high pretty, you know, as much as we could. And it kept on like that, you know, it didn't work out with her. We drank and got high and argued all the time. That's what we did. That was our thing. It was wonderful. Anyway, so, you know, another big point, when I was 23, my dad got diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and that was like, it didn't hit me at first, but you know, dad's gonna die, like, he's only got, like, 6 months to live. So I was, at the time, I was delivering pizza. It was funny, I worked, like, 5 p.m. to, like, 4 a.m. delivering pizza, just drunk. Just, like, really drinking, the whole way. I would have my fifth bottle, but I'd pour it into a 20-ounce bottle, and I'd keep it in my jacket. And I got pulled over, like, several times for speeding, and I drank bourbon is what I like to drink. It's not really bourbon, it's like cheap Kentucky whiskey, like $9 for a bottle. Benchmark, McAfee's Benchmark, old number 8. And I got pulled. I don't know if it was like the pizza topper, or if the cop was like, this guy's delivering pizza, there's no way he's drunk. But I never, like, they never breathalyzed me or anything else. I don't know how. Like, I had to smell, like, terrible. I was drinking, like, I would go to Rite Aid at, like, you know, usually, like, 10 p.m. every night and buy another 5th bottle, fill up, you know, finish working, wake up, and by 10 p.m. the next night, I'd finish that 5th bottle and go buy another one. And I mean, it was, I would shake when I woke up in the morning. I couldn't eat. I had to have alcohol in my system. I wouldn't have been able to drive a car if I wasn't drunk, which is, you know, but that's what, anyway, so my dad is sick, so I quit my job to go take care of my dad. My parents had divorced when I was 17. Dad was just kind of doing his thing. And anyway, so I go, you know, and I went to take care of my dad. And like, I wish that I could tell you that it was, like, noble. And, you know, partially it was. Like, I did take care of my dad. Like, it got to where he couldn't walk. I had to carry him to the bathroom. He would wake up at night and he, like, not, you know, scared, not know, he'd try to get out of bed and he'd fall down. But part of the reason I went down there is because I knew Dad was getting a lot of pain medicine. And, you know, when you're, like, terminally ill, they just fill the medicine. And, you know, he would break me off some, but, like, at the same time, like, I would also, like, go back later and steal. I stole my dying father's pain medicine. And, so that's, you know, it's not, it's like something that, you know, a normal person don't do that. And I really, like, at the time, I didn't see anything wrong with it. Like, well, whatever. They're just going to fill it up anyway. That went on. They gave him 6 months. He made it 5 months. And, like, one thing, you know, that he didn't want to go to hospice. He wanted to die at the house. But, like, eventually, like, he couldn't control his bowels or anything. We finally, like, had to put him, like, my mom was like, you have to put him in the hospital. And we put him in the hospital, and it was 7 days later, and he passed away. So he made, you know, he wanted to stay at the house, and he got to stay at the house for a long time. I'm strung out. When he passed away, I got a check for, you know, from his retirement. I got, you know, $48,000. By the way, I'm still on probation for the trafficking charge. So I got more time on the shelf. Back then, I don't know if they've changed it now, but I would go to the probation office drunk, and they didn't give me an ETG test. They didn't test my urine for alcohol. So I would clean the drugs out, and I passed for, you know, they finally put me on non-report. I did the thing for, you know, like 6 months, and he's like, okay, you're good, you know, you don't have to report anymore. And I transferred my probation. I was trying to do the right thing. I was lived in Fayette County, so I transferred my probation to Round County where my dad was, and I was like, well, you know, I'm on non-report. And so I was going, you know, I was still going to the probation office, but I got that check from my dad for $48,000, and my dad had just died. I was upset anyway, and I got a big check for a bunch of money, and I went nuts drinking and using, and they called me into the probation office, and I didn't think they were going to drug test me, and I went in and they drug tested me, and I couldn't run, like I was like, you know, and so they said, okay, well, you can go see a counselor. We're not going to lock you up this time. And you come back and pee again in a month and blah, blah, blah. And, a month came and I knew that I couldn't pass. And so I just, you know, I absconded. And it was getting worse and worse and worse. And, like, I switched to, like, 100-proof vodka from the whiskey. And, it was just stronger. I really didn't leave the house a whole lot. Like, I would just lay in the bed, and every time I'd wake up, I would, you know, down, like, 3 or 4 shots, and so I could go back to sleep and do my other stuff, and I just kind of stayed like that. I realized that I kind of had to do something. I'd heard about, like, detox, so I went to turn myself into the detox, I don't know why I did this, but I called my probation officer before, and I told him that I was like, yeah, I know, I fucked up, I'm going to turn myself into detox, and they said, okay, and they met me at the hospital and arrested me. I should have waited. They can't arrest you if you've been admitted to the hospital. I should have waited until I was admitted, in hindsight, but I don't know, I guess it was for the best. But yeah, they took me to jail, and I cold turkeyed off. You know, I was drinking at least a fifth of liquor a day by then, and I had gotten, I was injecting about, you know, at least 700 milligrams of oxycodone every day for, like, the past couple months. I'd been doing that. I'd always been on a lot, but that was, like, I mean, it was a lot. There's some days it was like 30s, you know, 900 milligrams. And this is like a little, like, podunk jail, and they should have taken me to the hospital, but they didn't. I went to see the nurse, like, they left me in, they took me out of the detox cell, put me in a cell by myself, because I was losing it, man. I was hearing things, and I was seeing things, and the nurse came in, and he said, all right, put your hands up against mine, and push as hard as you can, and he let go, and I mean, I was like... And he said, okay, well, maybe, he called the doctor, and he's like, well, maybe we'll, I think we have an exception to the rule here. I was like, no, so this dude's going to give me something, man. Thank God. He said, yeah, we're going to, you know, we usually don't give anyone any medicine, Mr. Duvall, but we're going to start you on 25 milligrams of Vistaril a day, which is fucking, it's Benadryl is what it is. It didn't do shit. They left me in there for... It was the hole is where I was. They left me in there for 7 days. And I was having, like, out-of-body hallucinations. Like, I could see myself. And, like, I thought that people were trying to get me. And I could hear the guards, like, beating people outside. And, like, none of this was happening, you know. This wasn't happening. It was a hallucination. I thought that people were trying to get me. They were trying to break me out of the jail to get me somewhere safe. I'm watching, like, finally, like, after, like, the seventh day, like, I just kind of snapped out of it and, like, came back. And, you know, it was like I didn't sleep for, like, another 6 days probably. Anyway, so I had to finish out my time on that one. I stayed there another year. Transferred me to the other jail, and I had to go to, I had to do I think y'all call it RSAT down here, it's SAP in Kentucky is what they call it, it's a 6-month program, so I was in rehab in the jail, for 6 months before they let me out, and they finally let me out, and, And the day they let me out, I drank again. I told myself the whole time I was there, this is crazy. That was fucked up. I can't drink like that no more. And the day they let me out, I started drinking again. And, 3 days after that, I was back on the other stuff, and I had to do 8 more months on an ankle monitor. I couldn't leave my house. But I could walk to the liquor store, and it wouldn't set off it would say I was still at the house. It was like God was, like, torturing me or something. You know what I mean? Like, it's like a sick joke. Like, you can't, you know, you're on house arrest. You're not supposed to be able to drink, but this liquor store, you can make it there. You know, it's like, I don't know. Give you enough rope to hang yourself with or something. And like, you know, I would go through this period for the next year of where I would drink, I would get myself all messed up, and then I would dry myself out. And then as soon as I could eat food again, I was like, well, maybe I'll just get one of them 25-ounce beers. You know, I'll just have one of them. That'll be fine. And then, you know, I'm drunk again. And you know, finally, like, I was living at my mom's house, and my mom was finally like, my mom charged me $200 a month rent. She's like, you got to pay something if you're living here. And she knew I had a job, and she knew that when my check hit, that the money was going to be gone the next day. So she would go and take the money out of my account before I would wake up so she could get her rent money. And then, you know, the rest of it's gone. That, like, it's sick, man. She's like, look, you gotta go somewhere. You can't lay around here. Like I come in, like, there's beer cans all over the floor. Like, there's, like, you know, and I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm going to get help. And finally, like, I woke up one morning, and I was, like, I would shoplift from Kroger. They sell beer in Kroger down here, don't they? Yeah, they did it in Kentucky, too. I would shoplift beer. There's a big beer cave, and I'd just stick them in my pockets and walk out. And I would do that, like, 5 times a day. Like, I want to just get 5 more, and I'll be good. You know. Just the 4th time today. It's not, and like, it was like 9 o'clock in the morning. I'd already been to Kroger twice. I'd done the rest of the other stuff, and I was like, I was out, and I felt like shit. And I was like, man, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. Like, I got the whole day to go. And so I was like, you know, I was like, Mom, I need some help, man. I need to go somewhere. And, she said, okay, and she took me to a detox, and, you know, they medically detoxed me, and then I got on the phone with some people. My mom knew a doctor that had went to MAR, which is down here in Atlanta, and, you know, you need to go to this place, and I did. I went, you know, I agreed to go, and like, I had wanted to quit drinking for, like, a long time, and I knew that I was an alcoholic. And I knew that I wasn't getting anywhere, but I just couldn't. Like, I didn't want to have to stop drinking to do it. Like, I wanted to be sober, but I wanted to drink. And I remember, the first day I got here, one of the counselors was like, you know, do you want to get sober? And I it's like the most honest thing I'd said in years. I said, man, I really want to get sober. And, you know, it was true. Like, no, I don't, but I want to, but I don't know any other way. Like, this is the way I've been living for, the way everyone I know has been living for a long time, but, you know, I stayed in the place, and, like, you know, I've been there, like, 30 days, and they're like, you know, you're supposed to have a sponsor by now. I'm like, what do you mean? You know, I don't know. It was like, I got here in, like, May, in Atlanta, and I was wearing, like, a sweatshirt because I was shit cold for, like, 60 days. It was, like, 85 degrees outside. I got a, like, sweatshirt. You know, my brain was just fried. So, you know, okay, well, I guess I'll get a sponsor. And I talked to this guy, and you know, I've, like, been around in that SAT program. I'd read the book and stuff like that, and there's a couple other treatment centers that I had gone to, you know, that I didn't mention, and stuff that was court ordered, and like, so I kind of like knew the general idea, and I could relate to the book, but I never like done anything with a sponsor, like actually worked the steps, so I started doing it. I didn't think it was gonna work, but like just the more I just like kind of tried to open up and be honest about like my alcoholism and the things that I had done, and that it was my solution, but it just wasn't really a solution to anything. It was a solution to getting thrown in jail in the hospital is what it was a solution to. That's what it did. And things started happening for me, and I liked going to meetings, and I liked talking to people, and it was like the first time that I met people that were like me that weren't using or drinking. And that was just, you know, I've been around a lot of people that told me how to get sober and they weren't sober themselves. That's how people are when you're out there like that. Like they know, people know, and I'm guilty of that myself. Like all you need to do is, you know, but this, you know, y'all weren't drinking. And you had been, you know, most of you had been far worse off than I had been. So I really took to the program, and I started chairing meetings, and I made it through the steps, and I got 19 months of sobriety, and I was still like going to meetings and stuff. My sponsor had relapsed. I got another sponsor, and I just didn't really like, I didn't really talk to him much at all. And there was some stuff going on with me, and I didn't really tell anybody about it. And it was like, wasn't really anything like, what it was like, I thought that I should be farther along. I thought I should have some things because I've been doing good. And my plan wasn't lining up with God's plan. And it was something that could have been solved like so easily, but I didn't, you know, I just wasn't listening. I wasn't using the program correctly. So at 19 months of sobriety, I relapsed. I went home for Christmas, and I was like, I'm just going to do a little bit, and I'll come back here and pretend like nothing happened. Even though history has shown me that once I put anything in my body, like I'm going until I'm, you know, can't eat anymore and whatever. I'm just going to do just this and then I'm going to stop. And like, you know, I don't know, surprise, surprise, I couldn't stop. And I came back down here and I kept on. But it was just like, it was so bad again, like, in like a week, it was like, I'm miserable again. And this lasted like 2 months, man. And I was like, I remembered like I just want things to go back to like just the way they were before, you know, before all this happened. Like I wanted to take it back, but it don't work that way. So I called some people at MAR and they got me into another detox, DeKalb Crisis Center. I've never been to like a nice detox. Like I've never been to like a Sunrise or anything, but DeKalb Crisis is probably like out of the plethora of detoxes that I've been to, it's probably like the worst one. But you know, they detoxed me. I got out of detox and I relapsed again. So finally, like I got into like this sober living and he's like, you know, you gotta be sober when you get here. I went back to the DeKalb Crisis Center and they said, dude, you just got out of here like 3 days ago. Like, no, you can't come back in here. So one of my friends who was sober, let me, let me, crash on his couch for a few days. And I didn't use. It was hard, but I made it through, and I got back into the sober living, and I got another sponsor, a guy that I'd always talked to at meetings and I really liked, and, like, I still have the same sponsor today, and he's, like, this is what I, like, I could tell this guy anything, man, and he's done everything I've done, like, 5 times, I think it's important, especially early on, to find a sponsor that you really like and think that you can trust and understands. That was this guy. One of the biggest things he told, I would always say, everything's good, everything's fine. And one day he was like, look, man, like, I ask you how you're doing, you tell me everything's good, everything's fine. I know it isn't. He's like, there's going to come a time where, something's going to happen to you, and there's going to be there's two solutions. One is, like, for you to drink, and the other is for you to just tell me what's going on. And sure enough, he was right. Something happened, and I called him and talked to him. I'm big about beating around the bush. I go, hey, man, what's going on? Oh, no. And finally, he's like, look, dude, like, what the fuck's going on, man? And I told him, and, it's been like I've finally gotten better about just coming out with it. Like, I'll meet him in person, I'll start beating around the bush. He's like, what's wrong? I could see it on your face. Just cut the bullshit. What's going on? I got back into the steps. But that's like the, I don't know, like, one of the biggest things for me is, like, I don't want to tell people a lot of stuff because I'm, like, I get embarrassed that this shouldn't be bothering me this way. Like, this is embarrassing. I don't want to tell anybody this. But all you have to do is tell, like, most of the time, we all feel the same way about it anyway. Like, yeah, it's embarrassing, but that's how you feel. It's whatever. And, like, just discussing this stuff with another alcoholic has, like, been one of the biggest tools for me being able to maintain sobriety. I got a good job. Like, I got a place to live. I got a 18-month-old daughter. I'm a full-time dad, right? Like, things aren't perfect, I'll tell you that. There's, like, some stuff going on but life still happens, but I don't have to drink over this stuff. Like, there's this stuff would, if I was still drinking and getting high, like, there's no way I could have handled any of this stuff before. And now, like, I'm capable of, like, with other people's help and with you guys and being able to come here, like, I'm able to navigate life and not just be so crazy all the time and like, not just, like, I don't know. Like, my kid would have been in a foster home or something, but it doesn't have to be that way. Like, things are okay, and, like, they ain't the way that I would like them to be, but that's not the way that the world works. And that was, like, a hard lesson for me to learn. Like, why can't it just be like this? Because it can. That's the way it is. God has different plans. My sponsor tells me all the time, nothing happens in God's world by mistake. Is it everything or he is nothing? I think that's mostly true. Or I believe that it's true today. I won't know till I die, I guess. Maybe not even then, if there is a God or whatever, if it's helping us out. But I like to believe that today. And the biggest thing that AA and sobriety have given me is, when I was drinking and using, like, I was pretty convinced that everything was going to end horribly bad. And it usually did. And now, no matter what happens, if I stay in here and I stay, with my prayers and talking to people, like, everything's going to be okay. I know everything's going to be okay. It might not be the way that I want it to be, but it's going to be okay. It'll be fine. I just lived with this, like, looming sense of, like, catastrophe all the time. Now, it'll be all right. So thank you all for letting me speak.
Thank you, Carl. I'm glad you lived through all that. And I love that it, hope springs eternal in here, does it? Every day. Awesome. Thank you.
Truckin', got my chips cashed in. Keep truckin', like the doodah man. Together, more or less in line. Just keep truckin' on home.
Arrows of neon and flashing marquees out on Main Street. Chicago, New York, Detroit, and it's all on the same street. A typical city involved in a typical daydream. Hang it up and see what tomorrow brings.
Dallas, got a soft machine. Houston, too close to New Orleans. New York, got the waves and means. And just won't let you breathe.
True love. Most of the time they're sitting and crying at home. One of these days they know they gotta get going. Out of the door and down to the street all alone.
Chugging like a doodah man. Once told me you got to pay your hand. Sometimes the cards ain't worth a dime if you don't lay them down.
Travel.